Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. As always, welcome to another exciting episode of Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. I'm your host, Maria Wall. And tonight, as always, we have yet another dynamic guest for you. I'm going to jump right into the show because our special guest tonight is the author of a book, Burnt Cookies, A Quest for Closure. I'm so excited about this guest. I can't even talk tonight, so excuse me for that. A Quest for Closure is a true account of a high school football player, Arnie Albert, who was groomed, betrayed, and sexually abused for years by his coach. Mr. Albert suppresses the abuse for decades until a phone call from a friend brings back the memories from the past. He finds out that a friend on the football team who was also abused by the same man. Together they plan a press conference in the local Chicago area in order to stop the man from hurting other youth. Albert's life dramatically changes as the newly revealed knowledge of his past is known now among coworkers, family, and friends. He begins to self-destruct in front of his family as alcohol consumption and moral boundaries are breached. In an attempt to resolve some of the raging issues, he seeks therapy and finally talks about the horrific experiences inside his soul, never revealed. A desire to reach closure finds Albert seeks out the man who abused him in the past in an attempt to finally confront him face-to-face. As a man. For months and months, he searches for the man and makes one last attempt to look him in the eye and discuss the past in hopes to find that closure. With that said, I'd like to welcome Mr. Arnie Albert to our show.
Hi,
Mr. Albert, how are you?
I'm doing just great, Maria. Thank you. That was quite an introduction, I am honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us here on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. As I said when we had spoken earlier briefly, this show is about you, and I have to say when I had initially read the book, when I first received the book, I was in my car after I had gone to the post office, and I started reading, and first I looked, you know, with a sense of puzzlement and bewilderment. Then it was a little bit of shock and awe, and then before I knew it, I was done reading the book. So it was one of those stories that I picked it up and I couldn't put it down. And I had been promoting you for a few weeks now, and so many people have a lot of questions for you, so I'll be asking them throughout our conversation this evening. But right now, I'd like for you to, I guess, start at the beginning and explain your upbringing, things like that, and then we'll work our way up to how you had come to be in the clutches of this manipulative individual.
Okay, I think I heard you say upbringing, so I guess I can start with a little bit of my past history, I guess. I was born in Chicago and grew up kind of in the southwest suburbs of Chicago, and very, strong Irish area where I grew up, and Catholic. I was born a Catholic, and still a practicing Catholic today. So in my upbringing, religion was stressed very strongly. We also, very disciplined. I had four siblings in my family, three brothers and a sister, and my parents both worked, and they, instilled in us at a very early age, that mindset that you were put on this earth to work, and you get up in the morning and you work hard, and you'll get your rewards from that. I did go to a Catholic school in a suburb of Chicago, and I also went to a Catholic high school in the city of Chicago, in the inner city of Chicago, and that was quite a change for me, going to a school and grammar school that was pretty much about 99% it was white Caucasian kids who were a lot of Irish kids, there were Polish kids and other kids from different ethnic backgrounds, but very strong Irish and Polish area. But when I went to high school, there was people who were from all over the city of Chicago, and there was African American, Asian, there was Mexican kids, Puerto Rican. So we had a very diverse group of kids going to school together, and it changed things a lot for me, opened my eyes quite a bit. It was a good experience getting to meet everybody that way. I also did go to a Catholic college and got a BA in business management. Let's see. I currently am married. I have two beautiful children. And they both went to the same grammar school that I did when I was a youth. I'm still in the same area that I grew up in. I'm still in the same suburb. And currently I work for a very large global law firm. I won't mention their name, but they are one of the largest in the world, and I work in their telecommunications department. As you know, I've just written a book, and it's going from there.
It's evident that you had a pretty stable family life, a melting pot of the neighborhood that you grew up in was very diverse. So, in reading the book, I guess let me start by asking this question. Was there a sense of, did your parents keep you sheltered from, I guess, in that time, people didn't talk about child molesters and things like that now, like they do now. So it wasn't something that was spoken about or taught in schools at that time.
Oh God, yeah. No. Yeah, I mean, at that time, today, it's pretty acceptable for people to talk about, their status as far as hetero or homosexual. There's no issues about it today at all. It's very common, but back then, in the 70s and 80s, if somebody even accused you of being, of being gay, you could be in danger of being hurt physically, for a boy, for a young man. So it was something definitely not talked about. Among kids, and definitely not talked about, among family, for sure. And it was just something that was never discussed, taboo, for sure.
Right. Well, I guess we're going to just jump right in and just come right up to you. Obviously, you had wonderful, uneventful sort of times in your earlier grade school, middle school, or back in our day it was junior high school. But I'm assuming that part is correct.
Yeah, I mean, I was your average kid in the Midwest part of the country. I played a lot of sports, went to school every day, had a lot of fun with my friends. Very very innocent, naive view of the world. In grade school, all those years, it was everybody who went to school with me was very much just like me. We were disciplined pretty harshly by our parents. We were taught to be respectful. We were a Catholic school, so we had nuns there, and we had priests that we, I was an altar server at the local parish. So it was a very, what's a good word I'm looking for, military type of an operation for me and all the other kids that I grew up with.
Right. Well, we've settled that part, so now let's move up to, I guess, when you entered high school. And that's really where it all begins to, I guess we could say, change for you, because you were then being introduced to things that you had never experienced before. And I think you had said it earlier, there was some sense of naivete there, because you were young and you were brought up in this very nucleotic family, and it was, you go to school, you do your homework, you get good grades, you be respectful of your elders, and you grow up and you go to college, you get a job, things like that. And, this is a good show because there are so many young people now who are extremely naive and unaware of what is actually going on around them. So with you telling this story, I'm sure that it will help some other young people to recognize signs of things that maybe their inner self are telling them may not be right, but they're not sure what to do about it. So bring us up and tell us how it all came to pass.
Well, I guess it kind of even started before high school. I mean, even before I went my freshman year, the man who abused me was one of the recruiters in the school. And he was very colorful. He was very passionate about what he was doing. And he drew people in. And there's no doubt he had a certain magnetism about him. He could talk to men, women, young people, and he just seemed to, people wanted to gravitate around him. There was just no doubt about it. So even before I even decided to go to the school, the attention that he gave to me, the attention that he gave to other people, made you feel special. He was very different from a lot of other men, and who I'd been around most of my life, who were much like my father, who didn't talk a lot, who didn't outwardly express, or didn't ask questions, didn't even ask you a question about how are you and what are you thinking and what's going on or anything. Just didn't act that way. But after I got into high school, my freshman year was pretty normal. There wasn't any, it was very uneventful. Nothing major happened throughout my whole freshman year. But in between freshman year and sophomore year, I played on the football team, and we had some summer football sessions. During one of these sessions, I broke my leg. So I couldn't play anymore. And, you know, for a good 2 months or so, I was, you know, walking around on crutches. And I didn't have anything to do, you know. So he wanted to give me, you know, a job to do something to, you know, keep me busy, I guess, on the team. And he taught me how to work the camera and film the games. So that was something I got to do, was film every football game. I couldn't play, but that sophomore year I got to film all the games. So he, you know, he showed a little extra special attention to me. And I really had never had anybody do that. It was a slow building relationship between me and this man. And, you know, that was nice. It was a nice thing that he did for me. He gave me some sense of purpose. And after my cast came off, he was also the athletic trainer for the sports program at the school, all sports programs. So once my cast came off, I had to do some rehab work on my leg. I broke it down close to my ankle, so I really couldn't walk too well. It was very sore. So I kind of had a routine every day after school. I would go into the whirlpool, and of course you had to be, you know, you had to be naked in the whirlpool. We didn't wear a bathing suit or anything. So I would come out of the whirlpool, I'd put a towel on, and he would put some creams and stuff on my leg and rub these creams in. And, you know, it felt good. You know, that felt good too. They kind of burned a little bit and made my leg feel better. It was part of my rehab. And, you know, he asked me at some point, he said, would you like to come to my house and do this, because I have a much better setup there. And, you know, I thought it was pretty innocent. I thought, okay, it's not a big deal. And I asked my parents, and they didn't think it was a big deal either at the time. He was, you know, one of the coaches at the school. He was one of the administrators at the school. He was the, you know, the trainer, somebody who was thought to be trusted with all these kids. So when I went there, he had kind of a massage table kind of set up. And, of course, I had to take my pants off, and I had to sit up on the table, and he started to work on my leg. And, you know, I felt, you know, it did actually feel good, you know, to have somebody, you know, rub these creams on you. And he asked me some questions about girls and about dating and, you know, things that nobody had ever asked me about, but things that I was so interested in. I mean, he knew exactly what was going through my mind, what would pull me in. So he continued to talk to me, and I think I went to his house a few times like that to have my leg worked on. And it was just me at the house, and there was nobody else there. He lived with his parents, and sometimes they were upstairs and sometimes they weren't home, but it didn't matter. Nothing was happening. And then at one point he asked me if I had ever, you know, had sex with a girl. And, you know, of course I got a little embarrassed by that. And, you know, I said, no, I have not. But of course, every young man's you know, goal and as a young teen is to you know, try to have a relationship with a girl and have sex. But I said no. And he told me, well, you know, if you give a girl a massage, that you can really get them in a state where you could probably get them to have sex with you. So of course that piqued my interest, and he said, you know, asked me if I wanted to have a massage. He said, "You want me to show you?" I said, "Sure." So he started to massage me. He had me roll over on my stomach and massage my back, and he began to instruct me. He said, "Here, I'll teach you how to give massages so you can do this to a girl." And it all seemed very innocent. It all seemed very normal to me. I didn't even think really much about it. But it didn't seem like anything was wrong with this. So massage my back, and then he started to, like, massage my calves, massage my legs, and he continued to massage my body. And then he said, okay, flip over on your back, and he, you know, began to, you know, massage the rest of my body. And at some point, you know, he asked me to pull off my underwear, which at that point I felt a little bit uncomfortable. And even before I even, you know, could react, okay, he was pulling it off. And he had put it on the floor, and so I was laying there naked, a little bit shocked at this point. This is a little bit abnormal, but, you know, as a young teen, and you trust people, right? You think that they're doing the right thing. They're not going to do anything wrong. So the massage continued. The teaching, the lessons continued. And he began to kind of to rub inside of my leg, close to where it connects to my body. And I did begin to feel very uncomfortable about it. And then at some point, you know, he rubbed my chest and was continually talking to me, teaching me, this is how you do it, and these are the things you have to do. And, you know, at some point he did, you know, reach down, and he did grab onto my penis, and he did begin to masturbate me, which was obviously a complete shock to me. It was a complete turning point in my life, and I think if that was one place I could get back to and stop and halt it and say, okay, I want to go back to that point. I wish it was before that happened, because I didn't know what to do. I laid there and froze. I know this wasn't supposed to happen, but here was this coach who I had put a lot of trust into and knew he was somebody that I was supposed to believe in. He coached me in football, and he was at the school. So after I had orgasmed, he had wiped me off and, you know, told me to get dressed, and then began to explain to me that this is very common after a massage. This is what they do all the time when he gets them. He goes, that's just what they do. It totally relaxes the body and made this whole process seem somehow normal. At that time, obviously, I was still in a state of shock, and it obviously wasn't normal, but he had made it normal. And at that point, I didn't stop him. I didn't say anything. I didn't really know what to do. I was kind of frozen. And I think at that point, he knew that he had me. He knew that he had me right where he wanted me, and there was not anything he couldn't do or make me do moving forward. So that was, a very pivotal point. And, you know, these sessions, you know, they continued. They continued to the point where, you know, I would even spend the night over at his house on a weekend. And, you know, during that time, my parents never thought anything was going on. They never questioned it. There was never anybody else that I saw sleeping overnight, so I thought I was the only one. And as we find out later on in the book, you find out that there's quite a few other victims that were, you know, molested by this same man. He had quite a system that he was working in high school. Do you want me to continue, or do you want me to take a break here?
Well, again, it's your story. So whenever you want to take a break, I'll just interject and ask some questions.
Go ahead.
And, you know, I guess around then you were around 15, 16?
I think I was between 14 and 15, yeah.
14 and 15. So that's even younger. When he started to masturbate you, did you voice your opinion at all, or were you were just totally in shock and awe, and you were just frozen, correct? And you didn't know what to do because, you know, he lived at home with mommy and daddy, and if you knew that they were home, did you ever think to yell out, or you were just frozen in time and you couldn't move?
I was like an ironing board. I mean, I actually just froze like a solid piece of ice. I didn't know what to do. I mean, nobody had ever done that to me. And, you know, morally, you know something's wrong. So you're stuck in conflict. You know this isn't supposed to happen. And here's this guy who, you know, has treated you better than any man has ever treated you in his life, has never done anything but good things for you. And this thing happens. So now what do you do? You know, I didn't have the the maturity. I didn't have the mental ability to make any kind of decision. So I think I did what happens to a lot of youths, or a lot of anybody who gets abused. You just freeze up. You just go into almost a state of shock, and you just can't believe what's happening, even though it's happening.
Yeah, and at such a young age, your brain is, the point of reasoning is just not there. And I suppose after things were over and you were on your way home, you probably thought to yourself, wow, you know, who do you talk to about it? Did you have anyone in the back of your mind that you wanted to bring it up to, or was it the fact that, you know, no one really communicated with you in the home? You said you had four brothers? Younger, older?
I had two older brothers and a younger brother,
mm-hmm.
and the oldest sibling was a sister.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's one of those things that just, it's one of those things where you say this keeps me up at night, and it does
mm-hmm.
keep me up some nights, believe me, is why didn't I? You know, why didn't I, one, you know, why didn't I stand up at that moment? Why didn't I have the strength, you know? And that's something that I've dealt with my whole life. And the other thing is, you know, why didn't I tell somebody about this? And I think as I've searched for that reason, one of the reasons, there's no doubt there's got to be a few other things that came into play, but I think one of them was just the fact that if I would have told somebody else about this, I could have been marked in the world as a homosexual. You know, and at that point, I do remember that, you know, anybody who was even questionable in high school, it was just a bad thing. I mean, if you were, you know, if there was somebody who was just a little bit feminine at all, you know, any man, any kid, wow, they had a hard time. They were just teased and abused, and, you know, it was just bad. Everybody was all, you know, made fun of them. And I really was, I think in the back of my mind, I really had this fear that if I said anything, if anybody knew about this thing that was going on, my life would, I wouldn't have all the things I was taught to have. I wouldn't get married. I wouldn't have kids. I wouldn't be able to get a job. I wouldn't have everything you're supposed to have. That, you know, like I said, that I was taught my whole life. You're supposed to go and that's what success is. You know, these are the successful things in life. Well, that wasn't going to happen if I was marked homosexual. And it's kind of like I created a small world for myself that I just left untouched by anybody else. And then I had my other world that I lived in with family and friends and other kids at school. So it was like two worlds that were kind of, they overlapped each other, but they were very, very separate. And I never touched until, you know, decades later when I was, you know, a grown man.
So, wow. You know, that's just, you have peer pressure on one end. You have a family life where you couldn't talk to your parents. And it's evident from listening to you that this man, he chose those of you who were younger to see just how far he could probably go. And once he knew that you probably would not tell, you think that made you more of a target for him. Do you think that there were ever, I guess down the road a bit, we're going to jump and then come back, but do you think that he tried it with some kids who threatened to tell? Or did you ever find any where they say, yes, he tried it with me, but I wasn't having it? Or
Yes, I. It's funny. After the press conference in 2004, of course, it was on the news. It was on, I believe the press conference was on NBC and CBS and WGN and Fox even, I think. It was in all the paper, you know, it was in the Tribune, it was in the Southtown Economist newspaper in Chicago and the Chicago Sun-Times. So, like a lot of people that I knew knew about it very, very quickly about what happened. And I did get some phone calls the following days after that press conference. And I got a really interesting call from an old high school friend of mine. And he spent the night at this man's house, too. And at one point, this coach told him he had to come and sleep in the bedroom with him. And for whatever reason, he just said no. He said, I don't think so. I think I'm gonna sleep out here on the couch. And he kept demanding, you know, demanding over and over again that he sleep in the bedroom with him. And for whatever reason, he was, you know, blessed by God to have that ability. His radar went off. I don't know how he had the tools he had, but something happened special for him that he did not get mixed up with this man that night. And he called me and told me that story. And he said, I never went over there again. He goes, I was afraid of him. He goes, he wasn't the same guy anymore. So there were, and I did get, you know, some other phone calls from other friends in high school who had a wide range of experiences with this man that I didn't know about. And it was really interesting just hearing all these stories. And, you know, it's funny, but none of them, not one person, told anybody else anything that they experienced. It was almost as if there was some kind of thing around him, protecting him somehow from people, you know, exposing him, because nobody did. Nobody exposed him at all.
Wow. It's, you know, I remember that era very well. You know, everything was pretty hush hush and quiet. And this man, I guess that he knew that he had, you know, the perfect setting for a quiet storm. You know, and it's so sad that
he kind of had a meat grinder, is what I kind of call it. He was stationed at the school in a position of authority. He was a coach. He was an athletic trainer. He had access to young kids. He was very well known in the area that he lived in the city of Chicago, and he was the head coach of the baseball team. So there was a lot of kids who wanted to get to know him so that they could play baseball in high school. So, I mean, he did have a lot of, you know, freshman year, you get a new set of kids to come in. And I believe he sat there and he actually studied kids and he watched us and he found out a little bit about our background. And I think he knew very, very, very early on which kids he was going to seek out and see if he could, you know, get that kid to go to the next level. And
right.
It's unfortunate. I think that hurts me the most, is that was my, when I thought he was being kind to me and saying, hey, you know, here's this kid from the suburbs going to a school in the inner city, I was a little nervous and afraid of some of the, you know, some of the people that were there. There wasn't a lot of gang activity, but, you know, the high school wasn't in the best area. And sure, there were some things to be afraid of, some things I didn't understand. And here was this guy who seemed to take me under his wing, so to speak, and, you know, just show me a little kindness. And, you know, it turns out all he was doing was, you know, he was putting me in a meat grinder. He was prepping me for the next stage. That's all it was.
And I think that that's probably one of the sadder parts, just because so many times we tend to look for that. As children, we need that nurturing and that closeness. And when we do not find it at home with our parents, so many times we do look for it, you know, in the arms and the faces and the smiles of others. And at such a young age, you know, you had no way of knowing that, you know, this man was not doing it out of the kindness of his heart. He was doing it because he had targeted you. And, you know, I'm sure that at some point when you look back on it, and especially after you talked to you had spoken to your friend, and he said, you know, something wasn't right, I never went back. Did you find yourself waking up and looking in the mirror and saying, you know, why the heck didn't you do it? You know, and I'm sure at some point it's evident, well, through reading the book, that you became disappointed in yourself, and then that started the downward spiral for you. Is that
Yeah, and I mean, you know, at some point after the relationship ended, and I call it a relationship just because it wasn't a consensual relationship while I was being sexually abused by this man, but it definitely was a relationship, and I was engaged with him in situations. So I call a relationship, for lack of a better word, but my mind digressed someplace, but I'm trying to get back to the point. What was that question? I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
I believe that at some point, you know, I just want some clarification, especially after you had talked to the other friend who knew that there was something wrong, and he had actually walked away. Did you wake up and you look in the mirror and say, you know, why didn't you have that wherewithal to do the same thing? And in reading the book, I know that at some point something had become the catalyst for you to go into that downward spiral. So,
oh, I'm okay. I remember where I left off now. It was, I mean, after the relationship had ended, I suppressed, you know, I guess I didn't suppress it. It was one of those things that ended, and I never kind of ever wanted to deal with it again. So that other world that I had created and built was kind of grayed out for that point, and I left it grayed out. But inside, it was always, obviously, all the things that happened to me were just, you know, I call it the monster in my book. It's kind of that, all those things, all those questions, all those, the loss of control, everything that surrounded the sexual abuse just festered inside of me. And, you know, it drove me to do a lot of things, made me act in a lot of different ways that I don't think I would have acted if I hadn't been sexually abused. And I didn't even think to understand what was happening to me, you know, until, you know, like I said, decades later, you know, I got that phone call from a friend of mine who was also sexually abused by this man. And he, you know, he kind of started it all. But to answer your question, after I started to deal with the abuse, go to therapy, talk to people, actually talk about what happened. I mean, imagine just for the first time, I sat there and actually said the words, this is what happened to me, you know, to somebody else. The questions keep coming. They still come. They're unending as to why I never just stood up and said, no, you can't do that to me. You know, why wasn't I the strong one? it's still, I think it always will. I think that's part of that, the quest for closure, is that there really is no answer. You know, God made us all different, and He gave everybody different tools. He gave everybody different graces, and I didn't have one of those abilities. And it just, I think trying to take the guilt and the shame of it all, sorry, I'm getting a little emotional, excuse me. Take some of that blame and guilt and try to deal with it. Say, you know, this was not my fault. But the questions, you know, I still ask myself that a lot. I still look in the mirror and see that little boy and wonder why. Why didn't I just say, hey, don't do that. You can't do that. But I didn't, you know. And here I am today, and this is the result. This is the result of what happened, you know. And I'm not the only one. I guess it's not a comforting thought, but it's something that I know that a lot of other people had those same incapacities, right? They couldn't do anything. They couldn't stop somebody.
Right. And it's quite all right. I understand. You know, this is an emotional subject for you, and I, like I said, if you need that moment, then just let me know. We can always go to a break if you need it. But I do understand how you feel when you blame, you know, yourself. It's more, you're beating yourself up for something that you had very little to no control over. And, you know, it's unfortunate that so many young people and older people find themselves feeling that way. The good part about this is there are a lot of young people that tend to listen to this show. And as you were speaking, I could just see this charismatic, you know, very friendly, jolly-go-lucky, everybody's buddy, you know, being your friend. And I know when I was in school, we used to have our favorite counselors and people like that, and we'd hang in their office. And, you know, at some point in high school, we had at least one who was very popular, and he would have cookouts and things like that, you know, on the weekends and things like that. And he would invite certain students and say, you know, you can bring your parents if you want, and you guys can all just hang together. And at some point, he had gotten caught up in a scandal, a sex scandal such as that. And I do not remember whether or not he was ever found guilty of anything, but I will say that, you know, I mean, I was invited to the house and all of that, but nothing of that nature ever happened. For me personally, I mean, I was witness to, you know, the drinking and things like that. And whatever happened with the students that stayed after hours and things, I really don't know. But I do remember that there was a scandal years down the road. So I understand what it's like to be drawn in by someone who is almost like your best friend, and that person that you can put your trust in. And, you know,
I think I saw a stat. Somebody sent me some information at some point, and I'm trying to remember who it was, but it's irrelevant. But I think the stats said that 1 in 6 males are suffer from some kind of abuse before they reach the age 18.
Yep.
Which is it's staggering.
Yep.
And I think a lot of people don't really understand that these perpetrators, these molesters, just terrible people are not you know they're not bums who are you know they don't look ugly or they're not offensive at all in any way. I mean, they're just the opposite. They are so meticulous about covering themselves, and they are, you know, the very, like you said, they are the people who everybody, they're the special counselor. They're the special teacher. They're very colorful. They're very charismatic. They have all those things that they bring a lot of attention. You know, they give kids a lot of attention. They have their, you know, their tools and their tricks to fool people. They gain people's trust. They're experts at gaining people's trust. I had a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine in high school. His parents were friends with this man who molested me. And they had him over to his house, you know, frequently enough for dinner. And I believe they even went on vacation with him at some point. I had full trust in him. And, you know, when this story broke out, you know, she had sent me an email and was just she herself put all the blame on herself because she felt like he fooled her as well as fooling all of us kids. He was so good at building trust in people and making things seem much different than they were. It was amazing. You wonder how far down the rabbit hole, you know, if you went there, how much you could find out.
And I can only imagine how many of your fellow classmates have yet to come forward, because they're still holding on to that shame, whether it be, you know, eating away at their craw, whether it's been suppressed. But, you know, it's.
I did get some phone calls shortly after that press conference by some classmates who were in my year and some who were in years after me, and they introduced themselves and told me that they were also victims. And I urged them, you know, to come forward with us. We filed a civil suit against this man. We exposed him, you know, to the world. We didn't want him to be around kids anymore. He was still teaching in the school system in the Chicago area. That was the main goal of the press conference, was to say, hey, let's get this guy out of the school system, number one, and get him away from kids. You know, but I also told him too, you know, he should try to seek out some therapy and try to talk to some people too about what happened. And I wish I had heard from some of those folks back, but they've never called me back since. So it's a lot to deal with. It's a lot of pain.
It is, and oh wow, you know, me as a female, you know, we go through so much hurt in our lives, and media usually puts all of the emphasis on the women and the abuse that we endure and things like that. It's not that often that they put so much, that they put, you know, that type of effort into the fact that men are abused almost equally nowadays. It's so heart-wrenching to, you know, hear you tell your story. And you know, most people were, some of the comments or questions that I had received in the past few weeks were, you know, you were a male, you played football, did you think to fight him at some point, because we'll get back to the book in a moment, because at some point it stopped being simple masturbation and it had moved forward to something even more severe. And, you know, of course, the typical questions are, many people want to know is, when did you know? I mean, why? I think the question that I got a lot was why? And why did you let it go on so long? And I tell people, you know what? And they literally were mad with me. You'd be surprised how people were, that's BS, blah, 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 and I would do this and I would do that. And I said, you know, this isn't a grown man that this happened to. You have to remember something. This was a young teenager. And then I would say, you know, how smart were you at that age? You know, and studies say that the male brain and the way that it matures and things like that, you know, I'm like, you cannot say what you would do until you're really in that situation. So I'm sure that you may get quite a few people who actually have come off to you that way. And have you found that to be the case, or have you found people to be more accepting and understanding at this point?
I'll tell you, I'll give you an example of one side of it. The first time I talked to my wife about this, and I kind of told her, I told her what happened. And she had a hard time. She really had a hard time understanding that the relationship was not consensual, you know.
Right.
She had a hard time believing that I couldn't say no. And I think the hardest thing, and I guess this is what helps me deal with it when I look at it, when I look at my own abuse and sit there and see that little boy, that 14-year-old kid who's, you know, who's helpless, I mean, who's really helpless, is that you're looking at it from the mindset of an adult. An adult has matured and has had so many different things happen in their life, has experienced so many other things. They have the ability to look at situations just completely different. You know, a 6-year-old kid and a 10-year-old kid and a 15-year-old kid can see the same thing happen, but they all experience it very differently.
Exactly.
And I know it doesn't, to me, there's parts of it that still logically don't make any sense. And I, believe me, I've emptied many bottles of alcohol in my efforts to try to figure it out. And there is no answer. And I think the people who say, well, why didn't you just do this? I don't think until you've experienced something like it that you can actually understand it. And it's not even understanding, because I didn't say to myself at the time, you know, it was as if I was lost in another world, and there wasn't a question. I never questioned if I should get in or out of this. I was just in it. I think fear was the overriding factor of my parents find out I'm going to be beat severely or grounded forever. if the kids in school find out, well, now I'm marked, you know, homosexual for good, and my life is over. And you know, that fear constantly was there subconsciously. You know, it wasn't as if I sat there and ran down a laundry list of reasons why I should and shouldn't do this. there was never even a concept in my mind of that I would even end it until, you know, at the end of high school, into college. I was still battling with just that fact of when I was, you know, that 14-year-old kid and it first happened to me, he still had that grip on me. I was still in shock, you know. I was so much in shock of all the things that were happening at that time to me. And as you mentioned, it did progress. You know, the things that happened to me progressed in the basement of that man's home. And I started to have, I don't know if we want to get to this part and stray away, but I started to have epileptic seizures. They ran tests on me. They couldn't find out, you know, why they started. There was no medical reason for it, but I just started to have them. You know, I think inside, I was just melting down. I was just absolutely freaking out from head to toe. And I think I just snapped. And my brain went to overload, and I started to have seizures. And they continued. I still have them today. And I'm on medication for them to control them. They're not as frequent as they were in high school. And sometimes in high school, I'd have them every day. And it was a very hard time for me, having all these different things happening to me, you know, one time. And trying to play sports, you know. And living in a suburban, very white suburbia, going to an inner city high school and dealing with a lot of the challenges there on a daily basis. And it all just got to me.
I'm going to ask you two questions for our listeners. Again, if you'd like to talk to Mr. Arnie Albert, our number is 646-478-4726. If you'd like to be on air and have a question or a comment for him. Two more questions that I received. Number one is, was there any time when you actually either considered or you did enjoy what you were doing? And the second question is, when it moved to the actual sexual act, how many times did he force you to have sex with him, and how did he accomplish that? Was the, I guess, the second part to that question. And believe me, had you been here with me, you could have sat down and had a roundtable discussion, because there are many people, if they have not already, they're going out to get the book. But these were questions that were thrown at me like this was my life. So, you know.
Am I being too honest? I mean, can I be as honest and frank as possible?
Yes. Oh, yes, extremely so, yes.
Okay, and I think I have been for the most part, but
yeah.
I can't. And I believe me, I think it's time that people understand what happens when someone's sexually abused. I think people need to talk about this so that the 1 in 6 of every male before they're 18 who's sexually abused, we start to understand why and start to maybe break the cycle. And that's part of why I wrote the book. But here, I'll get to your question. What was the first question?
Did you at any time?
Oh, did I enjoy it?
Enjoy.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. The very first time I went to his house, and he gave me a massage, you know, and I did enjoy that. I mean, I would be a liar if I sat here and said I didn't enjoy the way that felt, okay? But when the man put his hand on my penis and masturbated me, I froze and I freaked. And from that point on, I didn't want to be in the company of that man anymore. And he used his, you know, he used his manipulative powers and made me feel guilty to go over to his house. He would belittle me in front of people. He would pull me in outside of a classroom and make me feel bad. "Well, you're not my friend anymore," he'd say. "You don't want to come by my house? Is there something wrong? What did I do?" I mean, he had every line in the book to make the Irish Catholic white schoolboy, right, feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. I mean, I'm telling you, it worked. And I didn't know how to defend myself. You know, my parents, I wasn't brought up in a family where I spoke my mind. If I spoke my mind, there was a slap coming on one side of the cheek or the other pretty quick. And I learned to, all of us, all my brothers and sisters, we all learned to keep our mouths quiet and do what we're supposed to do or we were in trouble. And trouble meant, you know, you're going to get hurt. You're going to get beat. You're going to get disciplined. So I guess going back to the question, I did not enjoy it at that point. I did not want to be in that relationship any longer. I wanted to get out. I just didn't know how to. I didn't have the tools to get myself out. Didn't have the ability to do it. I was stuck in it. And the second question, which is a little bit more graphic, a little bit tougher for me to answer this question, but I will. I have talked about this before, and it's something that people need to hear. He never forced me to have sex with him. He never forced me. I shouldn't say never. He did force me one time to perform oral sex on him. And then it just became part of the ritual when we were together. Almost like I was a dog who knew what thing I was supposed to do next. But the one time that he wanted me to have sex with him, to have anal sex with him, we were watching some pornographic movies, and he asked me, "Would you like to know what it feels like to have sex?" Because I hadn't had sex at that point. And I was very interested in sex. And I think somehow me being still interested in women, still interested in wanting to have sex, somehow made all of this on some level still bearable, still whatever you want to call it, but I still could deal with the fact that I wasn't homosexual because I wanted, and at some point when these things were happening, I was dating other girls. So I wasn't relationships with women while this was happening. But there was a point where he did ask me that, "Would you like to know what it's like to have sex?" And of course, what kid, if you ask him, young man, of course they want to know what that feels like. You could ask a woman that. "Wouldn't you like to know at some point what that feels like?" It's sure. It's a human interest. It's something that I think everybody wants to know at some point. What does sexual intercourse feel like? So we were watching these pornographic movies that he had, and we were both laying naked. We had already massaged each other and probably masturbated each other at that point. But he was laying on his stomach and he said, "Well, if you insert your penis between my legs, it'll feel a lot like a woman's vagina." And of course I kind of was a little bit, I didn't want to do it. There was something inside of me that just morally, I was really, I think in the book I I stated that I was ripping my insides actually out of my body at that point. There was so much loss of control. There were so many things wrong with everything that was happening. I still had no ability to say no or to fight this. It was so emotional inside, but outside I was a statue. It was as if I was still in shock that anything. I couldn't believe this was happening to me. So I did. At some point, I did put my penis in, you know. And so as that happened, you know, of course you go, you know, into the motion of sex, and he's talking and teaching and trying to make it all seem normal, like he did with everything else. Everything seemed normal. And that was really strange about it. All these things were happening that were so abnormal. He somehow had a way to twist it and make it all seem like it was class. He was teaching me these things so that when I would get that opportunity to be with a woman, I would be successful. I would look like I know what I'm doing. He made it seem like he was really trying to help me be a good lover if that situation arose. Anyway, getting back to the point. At some point then, you know, he wanted me to put my penis into his anus, and he said, well, this will feel even better. You'll really get a feeling of what it feels like. And, I mean, that did happen. We did have anal sex at that point. And it was very, obviously it was very, very, very traumatic for me. He never forced me, though. He turned it into a lesson, like I said. And you know, that lesson got turned around. It got turned around on me, and I became the person on the other side.
And when you were in the middle of that act, did your mind? You just went through the motions. Your mind never said, you know, pull out and run. It was just, you were like an empty shell going through a motion.
Yeah, and
disassociated.
I kind of disassociated from it. I think I was so, upset internally from all of this that, yeah, I was kind of almost in a zombie state, just going through emotion. I actually remember looking at the TV and trying to imagine that he was the girl on the TV and that I was the man having sex with the girl. So that I kind of put myself in, you know, in that position so that I wasn't really having anal sex with my high school football coach. I mean, there's no way that could be happening. But it was, and I put myself into another little world, into the world of that TV, and said, "Well, I'm that guy, and I'm having sex with that woman on the TV." And I never questioned that I should stop this. I never questioned, you know, what's going to happen next. I never questioned any of it. It just all kind of seemed to happen, and he had full control. And it was almost as if when I went there, it was almost as if whatever the person that I was outside of there was gone. I just was kind of like a robot. Well, whatever you want me to do, I just do. He just pushed a button, and I did it.
And it's so eye-opening that your situation is not different at all from that, you know, that of course women go through. And people on the outside always ask, well, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? Until they're put in that situation themselves. And then, and only then, will they understand this is why. Because when we get to that point where we're simply existing and we're just empty drone bots or something, and we're just going through the motions, then that's exactly what it is. We've gotten to the point where we've given up, and we try to convince ourselves that tomorrow will be a better day, maybe, or that I guess it'll be over soon. You know, there's so many different defenses for it, and there's so many, you know, men are probably sitting home right now listening to this, thinking, well, you know, this guy is this and that. And I found in doing this show alone that when so many people are very critical of someone else, a lot of times they're going through something very similar in their life. And it's their way of getting their anger and frustration out by belittling, berating, and taking it out on the person who had enough courage to tell their story. And again, for the listeners out there, especially the parents, listen to your children. Learn how to talk to them. I'm not saying forget to be the parent and become their best friend and drinking and partying buddy. What I'm saying is your child is a human being. Your child is not a liability. Your child is not just someone that you can use on your taxes. Your child is a living, breathing human being with feelings. And sometimes you need to learn how to communicate with them, not just hear them speaking, but listen to what they have to say. Take notice to your children. Did any of your normal routines or habit or your person, well, not your personality, did you seem more depressed around the house? Were there any signs that your parents should have and could have or recognize to see that maybe there was something wrong?
Well, for me it was I had some physical things happening in my world when I started to have seizures. So I mean, that was one of the elements that kind of happened right at the same time that these abusive sessions happened to me. So I think my parents probably easily could have taken any kind of change in my my moods or my schoolwork definitely started to fail. I mean, I was an honor student in high school, and my grades just continually began to slip. As soon as I was able to drive, and this was, I think it was between sophomore year and junior year, I was out with, I was out with a bunch of the guys in the city drinking, a lot, to excess many, many times. So, I mean, I know my parents saw some of this, and my grades were slipping. I was spending a lot of time alone with another person, and I don't put any of the blame on my parents. I never will. They're both alive, and they both read the book. But I mean, they had a handful. They had five kids. They both worked. My father had a very important job where he was very, very busy, traveled a little bit. And there just wasn't a lot of time for that individual inspection. You know, as long as there wasn't, you know, how they say, there's not blood pouring out of any part of your body somewhere, or you weren't throwing up, you know, the complaints, yeah, we checked them at the door because we don't complain or we get hurt. So you don't really say much. You just kind of keep everything quiet and go about your business. So I mean, for me, that was, there wasn't a lot of things I would have shown anyway. And even if I did, I don't know if, because of the environment I was in, I don't know if my parents would have saw that, would have picked up on them. And I think that's something that, you know, when you see those stats on sexual abuse for women and men, you know, this cycle is just continuing from generation to generation to generation. There's got to be, you know, people have to become more aware. They have to start talking to their kids and make them understand. I've talked to my son and told him and said those embarrassing things to him, like, this area is private. This is an area that God doesn't even touch this area. It's yours, okay? A doctor, and that's it. You and a doctor are the only people who can touch that area. But I want him to be aware of that fact, that that's wrong, big time wrong, anybody touches that area or tries to or says that it's okay. And I think that's what our society has to change, that mindset.
This is true. And that's why I had gone on my little bit of a diatribe to our listeners that they really do need to take notice of their children, enlighten your children. You know, this, I realize that it's an uneasy subject to talk about, but it's a subject that's a necessity, because you could be saving your child from a very, very traumatic experience. That could lead to a lot of other issues, including death. In some cases, people who have been molested and abused such as this do not know how to survive and make it through. And the main people who we as children look to protect us, if we don't have that, then a lot of times, you know, we have nothing. And that's, even as we get older, we still do look to mommy and daddy when we're going through something to be their force, whether it be our protectors or the people that give us that kick in the butt to keep going forward and that encouragement. But parents, you need to take notice to your children. You need to get involved and know who they're hanging with, who they're talking to, who they're spending their time with. I'm not saying steal their phones and read all of their nowadays text messages and things, but you have to be more involved in your children's lives. Now, jumping to your parents, they've read the book, and what was their response when they found out that this was going on right in their own home? Well, you know, not it wasn't going on in their home physically, but this was happening to one of their children who lived in their home.
Yeah, under their roof, right?
Yeah.
Well, they knew about this long before the book ever came out.
Uh-huh.
And we held, you know, the press conference in 2004. And I had no intentions of writing a book at that time. I believe me, I'm a first time author. So, I mean, this is the first story I've written. So they did know about the abuse, and they were, you know, obviously as parents, very upset by it, very taken back by it, very silenced and humbled by it. I just can't even put myself in my parents' position. I remember we sat down. It was a Christmas. It was Christmas 2003, and we all sat down together. And I told them, you know, that we're going to do this press conference in January, you know, a month. And I said, you know, I had been sexually abused and kind of told a shorter version of the whole story about what happened to me with this man who molested me and sexually abused me for years. and kind of, it was a very emotional moment. I was very upset. I remember being in just tears and wailing and crying, and you know, my family kind of gathered around, and they, I mean, they supported me. They were behind me. Obviously, they had a lot of questions and a lot of things going through their mind at that time, and a lot of just, you know, how could this happen? You know, how could this? Things like this don't happen to us, right? But it did. And but, I mean, they haven't been very. Like I said, when I was a kid, they did talk a lot about personal things very often, and that was just my upbringing. So I mean, to this day, we don't talk about what has happened to me in the past, and we talk about if I'm in therapy or how am I doing, you know, with all of that. It's just kind of one of those things that it's just not talked about. It's kind of swept under the rug, so to speak.
Huh. Wow. Well, tell us where we can get a copy of the book.
Okay. It's on Amazon, of course. It's on pretty much every online bookstore that I've gone to look at. It's online, so you can go online and you can type in Burnt Cookies and search on it, and you'll find it there. It's also available through my publisher, and their website is
www.lumina.com.
www.lumina.com. Yeah, that's L-L-U-M-I-N-A.
And it's burnt, B-U-R-N-T. Not burned, people. It's burnt. B-U-R-N-T. Cookies. By Closure. By Arnie Alberts. And, again, this has been one of those subjects that it doesn't matter what gender you are. One can relate to what you've had to say. And for our listeners, you have to remember that Arnie was young. He was a young boy who was preyed upon by an older adult who he looked up to. And I believe that there are a lot of predators out there who look for people who are lonely or need someone in their life. And they know how to pick and choose their victim or their intended target. And it was evident that this man kept throwing bait and testing the waters to see just how further out to sea he could go, so to speak. And, again, this is not a grown person or college student this happened to. This was a high school child. And, you know, starting at 14, 15, you know, children are still very, their brains, their reasoning has not even really begun to develop. And when, again, they don't have the option of going to their parents, their protectors, and being, of course, in that particular era, to think that someone was gay or a queer or whatever the name was back then led to severe bodily harm and public chastising and beration, things like that. So even as a child gets clammed up, and which is not different from what a lot of us do as adults. So the realization is that we need to be more vigilant in shedding light on these types of situations, no matter what it is, whether you're an adult in an abusive relationship, the same principle applies. And, you know, Mr. Alberts, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story, because It is one that needs to be told, because the statistics on males being abused is staggering. And I actually question just how accurate those figures are, because, again, those are only the ones that have come forward and have been discovered. I add another few percentage points for those who are still sitting in silence. So, again, I want to wish you well in your continuing quest, I'm sure, to find that closure in every day that you tell your story. I hope that it brings you another step closer to finding, you know, that closure. Because that's a burden that I can only fathom. And I do wish you well. We have about 3 minutes left in our show. But, you know, me as a woman listening to you tell your story, you know, I can only relate to it from the female perspective, but I can also parallel it. So I want to thank you so much for coming on and telling your story here on Healing Through Her Talk Radio. And if you don't mind, I'll stay in touch and contact you from time to time just to see how you're doing and, you know, what's going on, and make sure that you're still on that straight and narrow path.
I like that, and I'd like to thank you, too, for having me on the show. And every time I get to not just talk about the book that I wrote, but get to talk about some of the things that happened in the past, always brings the gravity of what happened down a little bit. It takes that fear and knocks a little bit of a block off the top of it. So, you know, thank you, because I did get a lot out of being on the show and answering some of those questions. The one question was very brave, whoever submitted that question about, you know, was I ever forced to have, you know, sexual intercourse with my abuser? That's a great question. That's a tough question for someone to ask, and I'm glad they did. I really am.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and you keep moving forward, and you have been an inspiration and a shining light for someone listening, you know, at least one person, and I'm sure probably a lot more. So thank you for joining us this evening, and like I said, I'll be in touch just to say hello from time to time.
I look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Maria. Take care.
Good night.
Good night. You've been listening to my interview with Mr. Arnie Albert, the author of Bird Cookies, A Quest for Closure. You can get his book at Amazon and any online bookstore, as well as his publisher. Again, our guest next week will be mompreneur, advocate, and author, also on-air personality, Yvonne N. Pierre. Until next week, you be well, take care, and I'll see you soon.
Thank you for joining us here on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. As always, we'd like to remind you that the views, statements, and or comments of show guests, callers, or hosts do not necessarily reflect the views or beliefs of the Wall Foundation Incorporated or Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. These comments are those of our guests, callers, and hosts alone. Therefore, the Wall Foundation Incorporated and or Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio is not party to nor liable for resolution of issues between show guests, callers, hosts, and or listeners. I want to thank you again for joining us here at Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. I'm your host, Maria Wall, and I look forward to seeing you back here next week when we'll bring you more real people, real stories, real hurt, and real healing. Until then, be well.
Thank you.